This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 31 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winsor. And today, we are going back to the pre-Hogan WWF, or at least the pre-Hulkamania WWF, to November 13th, 1983, for WWF All-American Wrestling. So, airing on the USA Network on Sunday mornings, which I'll get into in a little bit because it was kind of a brand new show at that point. But first, just some quick plugs, if you'll indulge me. You can reach the show, greetings from Allentown, at gmail.com. That's via email. Twitter, GF Allentown Pod, at GF Allentown Pod on Twitter. Facebook.com/greetingsfromAllentown. I've gotten a lot of positive feedback about the Fortnite of Funk these last three episodes, and I really enjoyed doing it, and all the Terry Funk that I could have possibly wanted during that time period. The only one that I thought about that maybe I could have done but didn't, because I don't know if that episode is on YouTube right now, is the 1997 episode of Shotgun Saturday Night that they did the night before the Royal Rumble. The infamous one where Terry Funk said, "Your mother's a whore." But whatever, I had already done a Shotgun show from 1997. And part of the reason why I'm doing this show here today is to fulfill my goal to do something from every year from 1980 through 1999. So once I've got 1983 covered after this show, I will only have 1981, 1995, and 1999. And yes, I've kind of avoided 1995. It's not the greatest year in the world, but I'll get there eventually. You're probably listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, and you should be listening to another show on the feed, and you won't miss it if you subscribe, called WorldCast. Now, WorldCast, that kind of sounds like a simple name. Well, they are reviewing world-class championship wrestling shows from 1982. And by they, I'm referring to three-quarters of the titans of wrestling. Kelly, Pete, and Johnny Sorrow, the funniest man in podcasting today, which was certainly proven in the third episode that came out last week. PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon. Do all your purchases for Amazon through there. I think I was going to make an Amazon purchase the other day, and I think I left it up in the window. I need to go back to that, so I'll do that after I'm done recording here. I don't even remember what it was I was supposed to be buying, if it was coffee or that WWF or WWE unreleased DVD that came out first week of September that has all sorts of weird matches that we thought we would never see, like the Toxic Turtles and stuff like that. So Do your Amazon shopping, placetobenation.com/Amazon. And as I've mentioned, a lot going on at placetobenation.com, such as the Greatest WWE Wrestler Ever Project, easy for me to say. And just a lot of discussion about various wrestlers. And just give it a look, and you will probably learn something. Now, WWF in November of 1983. I mentioned this in the intro to last week's show, that I had been watching a house show from the Philly Spectrum during that month and year, and how just overall it was just completely atrocious and a bit of a train wreck. And I still haven't gotten through that entire thing. I didn't even make it to the Bob Backlund Iron Sheik match that's on that show. But things are very, very stale at that point in time in terms of the in-ring product, and the presentation isn't quite there yet. You have Bob Backlund, who is in his sixth year as the champion, having won it in February of 1978. So this is now 5.5 years in to his title reign. Your Intercontinental Champion is the Magnificent Morocco during his second reign, and he had held the belt for quite some time and all the way through 1983. So there's not much there, and your hot baby face of the time is probably Superfly Jimmy Snuka, and he had baggage coming out the wazoo given what happened with him and Nancy Argentino in May of 1983 after one of the Allentown tapings. We all know what happened there, so yeah, you can't really do too much with him. You can't put him too far out front, because that stuff that got buried back then may bubble back up to the surface. And Vince McMahon had purchased the company from his father starting in 1982, and the whole process of the sale, which I explained in episode 7, took a year. The payments out to Gorilla Monsoon, Arnold Skolin, Vince Sr., and the others. I think Phil Zacco was in there as well. So it took until mid-1983 for Vince to fully control the World Wrestling Federation, Vince Jr., that is. So it's kind of like he's circling the airport, waiting for clearance to land the airplane, waiting for a runway or something. So when he gets control, he can't shift the title off Backlund before then. So he has to kind of wait for the right opportunity. And when he does take control in the middle of 1983, that's when you start seeing some changes that aren't readily apparent on television. They're more behind the scenes things. The most obvious of which is pulling out of the NWA at the annual meeting in Las Vegas in August of 1983. And the WWF had pulled out of the NWA in the past. 1963, they go their own way, but that really only lasts about the length of Bruno's 8-year title reign up through 1971, and they rejoin the NWA at that point for a period of 12 years. So through the rest of Vince Sr.'s controlling time in the company, they are members of the National Wrestling Alliance cartel. One other thing that changed around this time was that they got on the USA Network in August of 1983. This show, All American Wrestling, premiered, taking the place of Southwest Championship Wrestling, which was the first wrestling program on the USA Network starting in December of 1982. And it was not really for a lack of popularity that Southwest came off of the USA Network. It got very good ratings, but there were some money issues there where they were paying apparently $7,000, $8,000 a week for the time slot, and they couldn't really afford that in the long run. It's also been said that there was an issue with an angle that aired on television at that time with Bobby Jaggers getting cow dung flung over him. It's actually from Terry Funk's book. He mentions this a little bit, and I'll read what he said there. Vince Jr. first got people's attention when he got on the USA Network slot for his WWF show from Joe Blanchard's Southwest Wrestling Group. There was a money dispute between Joe and the network, and USA pulled Joe off the air. I don't know exactly what the dispute was, but I do know it wasn't Terry Funk's idea of dumping cow shit all over Bobby Jaggers. Yes, that was my idea, but that was not the reason the show went off the air. So yeah, don't hold Terry Funk culpable on that one. It was Vince going to the USA Network with a better deal, which is something that would repeat itself for years to come. Southwest was kind of making a play there. They had had a tournament to crown a world champion, which was a little strange to call yourself the Southwest Wrestling World Champion when you've got a regional name to begin with. And Adrian Adonis, who we actually see in this program, won that one-night tournament to become the quote-unquote world champion. So All American starts up in August of 83, and the first few shows are just kind of introductory deals where they would devote an entire episode to the career of Bob Backlund. There's another one with Andre the Giant, Chief J. Strongbow, kind of introducing their biggest stars to a national audience. Eventually, that would evolve into a weird sort of program where yes, they would show matches from Championship Wrestling, from All-Star Wrestling, kind of replay them on here, but they also started showcasing guys from other promotions, which seemed head-scratching to some at the time. You see guys from the AWA, from Championship Wrestling from Florida, other promotions. I think Mid-South had a couple of guys appear. I think Magnum TA may have appeared on All-American Wrestling at one point. Some people were on to what Vince was really up to here, which was to showcase these guys to his own audience so that when he would come and pluck them from there and bring them to the WWF, that his audience would already be familiar with the act. But for right now, there's a real malaise while this is going on in the WWF. The cards that they were running out there at that time, and I've mentioned the Philly Spectrum, for one, were not very, very good. And it was not a particularly enjoyable product. To give you an idea of what the WWF was like at this time, let me read off a card, and this kind of caught my attention because it's the same day that this show aired, November 13th, 1983, so it was on a Sunday, and it was in Reading, Massachusetts, which is next to where I grew up. I have a lot of friends who live in Reading as I speak right now. It doesn't give a venue. I'm kind of curious to see where they might have held a card in Reading, maybe a VFW hall. The independent promotion around here doesn't hold any shows in Reading, so I have no idea where they would have gone with this. Their ice arena wasn't built at that time. So here's the card that they ran out there. There's no attendance given. Swede Hansen defeated Pete Doherty. The Iron Sheik defeated Chief J. Strongbow, so those are two kind of big names there. Invader No. 1 defeated Don Kernodle. Invader No. 2 defeated Rene Goulet. Tonga Kid defeated Fred Marzino, local guy from Stoneham, which is just south of Reading. Rocky Johnson and Tony Atlas defeated Samula and WWF Tag Team Champion AFA via disqualification. So that is your card in Reading, Mass on that date in 1983. Nothing too exciting there. As I said, people were worn out with Backlund. You couldn't do really anything with Snuka. And even Eddie Gilbert, who was a young, promising guy coming up, had his car accident in May right around the same time as the Snuka incident took place. And he was out for quite a long time with a neck injury. And we see him on this show training with Bob Backlund. And it's a really, really just bizarre and weird stuff. Some more changes to the WWF around this time. The Grand Wizard of Wrestling, Ernie Roth, passed away in late October, which left a lot of guys who were under his charge in limbo. You have Sergeant Slaughter there, although he appears on this program with the Grand Wizard at his side, even though the guy had been dead for several weeks. Very, very strange there. Iron Sheik had come in to the promotion, really appearing on television only, not working any sort of house shows leading up to the big angle at Madison Square Garden, where he did capture the world title from Bob Backlund. Paul Orndorff had just come in from Georgia around this time. And of course, he would be a mainstay for about the next 4 or 5 years in the WWF, main eventing WrestleMania 1 and having that huge program with Hulk Hogan. But on this show here today on All American, there are some key players who would play a role in the WWF in 1984 and beyond, even though some of them weren't even in the promotion at this time. If Sergeant Slaughter, as I mentioned, Barry Windham in a match, Championship Wrestling from Florida, he is on the show as well. And of course, he would come in at the near the end of 1984 and form the U.S. Express. The Fabulous Moolah is here, and of course her angle with Wendy Richter in the middle of 1984 launched the Rock and Wrestling connection. And there is an Adrian Adonis versus Hulk Hogan match from the AWA. We do not see the entire thing, but it's very interesting to see an AWA match on WWF television, given the fact that Vince was about to go to the mattresses against Vern Gagne. And oh yeah, there is one more match here for those of you who could not get enough of Tony Garea on last week's episode, he's back again this week, and he's taking on Iron Mike Sharp, who was something of a mildly pushed commodity. He was not completely jobbed out at this time. So, yes, Tony Garea in the ring this week, not in a bar fight with Terry Funk. So let's just jump right into the show. The show opens with a clip from the Tony Garea versus Iron Mike Sharp match, because when you're looking to expand nationally, that's the matchup that you want to present for the masses. Anyway, cuts quickly to Vince standing in the studio, and one thing that I noticed through this entire show is that Vince McMahon is very stilted and awkward at this time. It didn't really seem like he was comfortable at any point during this show. Except for the point where he mentions Hulk Hogan, where I notice he's kept a really, really good poker face as to what's going on. He does say that the Fabulous Moolah is up first here. But first, we have the first of three different ads that we have in this video for Victory Magazine. And it's our good friend from last week, Lord Alfred Hayes, in what has to be one of his first appearances on WWF television. He had come over in 1982, but was working as a road agent for about a year or so. And it actually said on the Wikipedia page that he made his debut on air at the December 1983 MSG show doing interviews backstage. That's the one with the Backlund Iron Sheik title change. But here he is in November doing an ad for Victory Magazine.
And our leisure time here in England, I, Lord Alfred Hayes, master of my own domain, I read Victory Magazine. Total coverage of wrestling throughout the world. International stars like Bob Backlund, Sergeant Slaughter, magnificent photography, and competent reporting. We make sure we never miss Victory Magazine here in England. So nice with a cup of tea.
Okay, first of all, I as a Seinfeld viewer, when Lord Alfred says that he is master of his domain, all I can think is Hayes trying to tell us he never beats off? Is that what but no, that hadn't been invented yet. So he's giving off a more dignified air than the kind of buffoonish guy that he would become in future years, you know, when he's the sidekick on TNT. He's channeling Masterpiece Theater quite a bit, sitting in the chair, the comfy chair. Or if you prefer, he's channeling George Plimpton from Masterpiece Theater on the Disney Channel, but that was several years later. And, you know, he goes Bob Backlund, Sergeant Slaughter. I thought he was going to say Magnificent Morocco, but instead he says Magnificent Photography and Competent Reporting. Competent reporting. Way to just put that over. I don't know what exactly he was trying to get at. So our first match was taped October 4th, 1983, in good old Allentown between the Fabulous Moolah, the World Women's Champion, which they were saying she was not the WWF Women's Champion because they did not have a women's division as such. So that is how she was built. Eventually, Vince would buy the rights to the title from Moolah, which is how it could get on to Richter and all that down the road. But that's a whole complicated piece of business here. And she is taking on Penny Mitchell, or is it? But as I said, it's nice to have Joe McHugh here, but he was about 80 years old, and he was certainly prone to some errors in his announcing.
In the corner to my right, from Springfield, Missouri, weighing 150 pounds, here is Penny Marshall.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, Schlemiel, Schlemazel, Hassenbemp Incorporated.
We're gonna do it, give it
Yeah, it just brings me back to Laverne and Shirley, theme song playing underneath right now. One of the biggest sitcoms of the late 1970s, starring Penny Marshall alongside Cindy Williams, at least until the last few episodes when Cindy Williams up and left the show. Number one show in 1978-79, and then the next season, they jerked it around the schedule, ABC did, to try and improve the ratings of other shows, and the show fell out of the top 30, and it regained some popularity, but it was never the same. Of course, they also moved the show out of Milwaukee to Los Angeles, and it kind of lost a lot of its oeuvre at that point. I definitely didn't support that movie. That was a Milwaukee show through and through. Come true for me and you. I do enjoy Laverne and Shirley. It was a pretty good show for its time. But Gary Marshall, Penny Marshall's older brother, certainly had the magic touch back in 78, 79, because I believe he had four out of the top five shows on television in the ratings. He was the producer of four out of the top five shows. It's unbelievable. That's something that'll never be broken. So yeah, Joe McHugh calls Penny Mitchell Penny Marshall, which Laverne and Shirley had just gone off the air the previous May, so maybe, you know, everything in mind there. I don't know. And like I said, the guy was 80, and I'm willing to cut him a break just because of the pipes there. And there's a lot I have to say about the fabulous Moolah, and there's so much out there about her and such a controversial figure. I went down a research rabbit hole for a good 2 days on this woman. And so I'll talk about that a little bit more after the match. This is a very odd broadcast pairing for this one. It's Gorilla Monsoon and Pat Patterson. So, hey, Gorilla, why don't you make your gay jokes about Patterson to his face now, okay? Moolah with the mare by the jacket. See, Moolah, her working style was mainly snap mares by the hair, snap mares by the jacket, which Mitchell still had on. Tosses her outside and then kind of preens to the crowd opposite hard camera, and Mitchell jumps back in the ring, drop kicks her out, and she's very, very woozy outside the ring. And they say that I'm sure Moolah has had her share, her few cobwebs over the years. I didn't quite understand what Patterson and Monsoon were getting at there. Back inside, she offers a handshake, and Mitchell does that thing that I've talked about before where she looks around like a confused Price is Right contestant. Like, I've got to look around to the audience. She goes for it for a little bit too long and gets kicked in the gut there. Monsoon and Patterson keep talking about how all the times Moolah has wrestled hurt, which I thought was a very weird angle to take. Of course, given what we know about Moolah, she's hurt a lot more people in, I guess, an emotional sense. When you think about it, Gorilla has his own Joe McHugh moment.
Penny Marshall here, really getting an education and a chance of a lifetime.
Well, yeah, in a few years, she's going to be able to direct A League of Their Own. So, very critically acclaimed film there. Pat says that other women can wrestle better than Fabulous Moolah, but it's her experience that carries the day. Okay, all right. Now, Moolah as a wrestler is really, really bad. And I think anybody will admit that. Even the biggest Moolah apologist who works in the offices of WWE would have to confess that. The thing was, of course, she had everything kind of under her thumb for the longest time, which meant that with her in control, nothing was ever going to change for the longest possible time. Compare that, say, with, oh, I don't know, Japan, where you have this women's scene, all Japan women up in the 1990s. Perhaps if in the United States, women's wrestling had been allowed to blossom at any particular point in time, the United States would have had that. But really, we only had a few great women wrestlers here and there. One of whom was Judy Martin, who was just criminally unappreciated from the 1980s. And of course, her series with her partner in the Glamour Girls, forgive me, Leilani Kai. I don't know why I forgot Leilani Kai's name, because she was very important there. With the Jumping Bomb Angels, where Judy Martin claims that they were supposed to have a match at WrestleMania 4, which did make sense because they did have a match at the Royal Rumble in 1988. And that would have been something really exciting to have added to that WrestleMania card, which is very dry and boring. I'm not sure what would have gotten bumped from the show in its place. Hopefully Ultimate Warrior versus Hercules, since that was a 6-minute really kind of a waste of time there. So Moolah, I've struggled to try and come up with good things to say about Moolah, and her hair dye game is very, very strong, as she misses a stomp here. Her hair dye, it's extremely dark. It's not the color that you're used to seeing from later in the 1980s. Both of them go for a drop kick and miss. This is not exactly Eddie Guerrero versus Dean Malenko here, is, you know, the point I want to make. Then Moolah misses a splash, and then Penny Mitchell misses a splash as well. And now it's turning into like one of those Jeopardy games where two out of the three contestants are in negative territory, and you think, we're going to get the final Jeopardy, and there's only going to be one person eligible for it. So this is pretty damn bad. We get a toe hold, which gets broken by Mitchell into a monkey flip. Penny with a mare of her own. There's so many mares. I mean, this is like this is like Calumet Farm, how many mares you have in a women's match this time. Another missed drop kick. A backdrop attempt that just goes really, really poor from Moolah, kind of dumping Mitchell on her front, not so much on her face, but kind of just lands on her stomach, and puts Mitchell up on the top rope and tosses her off by the hair, and then a splash finishes this. And Moolah and her tyranny of this is everything that the worst of the IWC complained about John Cena. You know, John Cena, blah, 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 and all that. Moolah was actually guilty of that. So I will say one good thing about Moolah as she goes into the interview area with Pat Patterson. It's that women's wrestling was banned in New York in the early 1970s, and she helped get that overturned. So I will give her credit for that, because it is kind of a stupid thing where women aren't allowed to, you know, participate in a professional wrestling event in the state of New York. So any role she might have had in overturning that, I certainly endorse her for that. So Patterson is with Moolah, and Moolah claims she's all about the money, which, no shit, Sherlock. Her name is Moolah. That's a term, of course, for money. Her eyebrow game, not as good as her hair game, or her hair dye game, because she has kind of those Joker eyebrows, like the painted-on eyebrow. Now, I appreciate a good eyebrow, but when it's all painted on like that, it just looks completely ridiculous here. So let's play a game of true or false with some of Fabulous Moolah's claims during this promo. First claim. Claims she has been the champion since 1956. That is not true. She had been beaten for the title many times. She would hold it for long periods of time and then lose it for a few weeks, and then inevitably regain it back. Claim number two. 15 years ago, she beat wrestler Luis Martinez. Well, Luis Martinez is kind of a famous guy in the 60s and 70s, and apparently, from my research, is huge in Nigeria. And I would have never even known wrestling existed in Nigeria without the little excerpt from the Terry Funk book that I read, where he complained about the promoter over there. Apparently, Luis Martinez is a pretty big deal in that country. And Moolah claims to have beaten him 15 years ago, which would place that in 1968. I could find no record of it, but I'm going to go out on a limb and say that Mula is Mula is full of crap on that one. Then, for some reason, this is a really bizarre interview. She brings up the prospect of actually wrestling Pat Patterson, and Pat says, "I might enjoy that." What we know about Pat Patterson, I don't think he would have enjoyed that, at least in the carnal sense.
He prefers the company of men.
Now, Mula says she had been married, and in fact, she had been married many times, including at age 14. So, yeah, she was pretty screwed up from the get-go. Granted, you know, South Carolina in the 1930s was a very different place than what we know. She was married to a fella named Johnny Long later on, who I think is the one she is referring to when she says this.
I'm not married at the time, but I have been married. And the only problem I had, I was more popular and better in the ring than he was.
That's casting some real shade, given, as I said, how bad Mula was in the ring. So, you know, I've struggled to come up with really anything good to say about her. She was exploitative, both financially and sexually. The financial stuff I can understand to a point, because it was kind of standard for a wrestling trainer to take a certain percentage of a wrestler's earnings for the beginning of their career to kind of as a payback or whatever. And she probably took too much of that and was taking the payoffs for all the women in the locker room and then doling it out as she saw fit, with much of it obviously going to herself. And any sort of pimping or whatever that she's been accused of obviously is completely indefensible. So she's not somebody I particularly like talking about, an extremely complex legacy. And if you want to figure out how complex, consider the fact that WWE, who has always soft-pedaled on this kind of the dark side of the Mula legacy, they named the women's tournament after Mae Young that they're holding right now, when Mae Young, of course, has some issues of her own that David Bixenspan reported on, I believe it was about a year ago, with certain things that she has had in the 40s or 50s or whenever that took place. So yeah, just compare women's wrestling in the United States in the 80s and 90s and contrast it with what was going on in Japan, and a huge chunk of the blame for the giant seismic difference in quality can be laid at the feet of the fabulous Mula.
On this team, we tear ourselves and everyone else around us to pieces for that inch. Yeah. We claw with our fingernails for that inch. Because we know when we add up all those inches, that's going to make the fucking difference between winning and losing. Yeah. Between living and dying. Yeah. I'll tell you this, in any fight, it's the guy who's willing to die who's going to win that itch. And I know if I'm going to have any life anymore, it's because I'm still willing to fight and die for that itch.
While playing Al Pacino's speech from Any Given Sunday might seem a little random on a wrestling podcast, I couldn't help myself because of the fact that our next bout, which takes place in Championship Wrestling from Florida, and is so weird because you have Gordon Solie and Eddie Graham announcing a match on WWF television with Bill Alfonso as the referee, although Bill Alfonso would referee matches eventually down the road, at least in WCW. I think he was in WWF at one time or another. The opponent of one Barry Windham, who is our star here, is Tony D'Amato, or Tony D'Amato, as it's spelled. Yes, the exact same spelling as the coach of the Miami Sharks from Any Given Sunday. So, of course, you got to play a little bit of that speech. You can't discuss that character without the inches speech that's been played at sporting events ad nauseum. 5 minutes left in the third period. Bruins down 3-2. Oh, they've been known to play that. You know, basketball games, anywhere. Really. So this is truly a snapshot of how bizarre this arrangement was with Vince McMahon airing other promotions' matches in order to showcase somebody, in this case Wyndham, who he wouldn't get for about another year when he would come in team with his brother-in-law Mike Rotundo for about a year-long run in the WWF. In this match, there's not too much going on here. In fact, D'Amato has kind of control for much of it early on. Wyndham gets arm-dragged, and he doesn't look particularly strong early on. Wyndham does get a drop toe hold into a hammerlock, but it's not exactly the prettiest drop toe hold that you've ever seen. Although it's certainly better than David Flair on Nitro in 1999 against El Dandy or anything like that. It's not quite that bad. Vertical suplex here, but since it's Gordon Solie involved here, it's a vertical suplex, which sounds like a very fun dessert. Big leg drop by Wyndham, but that only gets two because he's not Hulk Hogan. You get a little brief D'Amato comeback here. This is a very quick match, but he misses a back elbow, and Wyndham comes off the ropes with a huge lariat, a Texas-style lariat. The guys outside of Texas are allowed to use the lariat as the finisher. It seems like it's only guys from Texas with that certain pedigree. So yes, this is a very strange match. It's not very impressive by Wyndham. He doesn't get to show off a lot of his moveset. And it's just really, really weird that this match is the one that we're showcasing, which might be the reason why they said, here, Vince, you can air this. And Wyndham didn't look all that great, and yeah, you probably don't want him. But soon enough, Vince would come a-knockin' for Wyndham. And that U.S. Express team with Mike Rotundo was pretty fun, and they are kind of forgotten because they didn't stick around for all that long. Of course, they lost the tag titles on the first WrestleMania, which is probably their highest profile match. And it seems like, in retrospect, even though they had two tag team title reigns and were wildly popular, you watch the television from 1985 and the cheers that they would get when they would come out, perhaps assisted by the fact that their theme was Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen, a wildly popular song at the time. But those guys were as over as any tag team in the mid-1980s in the WWF, and it all kind of got wiped away because Barry Windham up and left, sick of the schedule. Was it Barry Windham's flakiness? Well, he left and ended up going back to Florida, which was kind of an odd situation because he couldn't go right to Jim Crockett Promotions because Dusty Rhodes was booking, and the way Wyndham had left Florida when Dusty was still the booker there had left kind of a sour taste in the mouth of the Dream. So he had to kind of do his penance before he could come in and do his matches with Ric Flair, the legendary 60-minute matches. I think there was a match at the Battle of the Belts as well. So a great performer, maybe not somebody who was so determined enough to become a world champion, but as I've said on this show so many times, just because you have the ability to become a world champion, there's no shame in the fact that it never happens, especially since Wyndham may have prioritized other things over wrestling, I guess, in his personal life. I don't want to go too far down that road, but all in all, he had a very strong career. It is a shame, though, that his 1990s were just not all that it could have been.
We are young.
I've said it before in my journey through 1984 WWF television last summer that was one of my favorite bumpers, Love is a Battlefield by Pat Benatar, that they would use on the shows, although it was never as good, and I've probably said this on an earlier podcast, that when they would play I Want a New Drug by Huey Lewis when a particularly roided up guy was in the ring. Not going to name names or anything, but you can probably figure it out. Our next bout is actually from the World Wrestling Federation. We're not borrowing from other promotions here. And it is Sergeant Slaughter with the late Grand Wizard, as I had mentioned in the intro to the show, facing off against Ken Jugan, who is a guy who would appear on WWF television fairly frequently in the mid-1980s. And he has a rather interesting backstory for a quote-unquote job guy. In fact, you can't even really call him a purely enhancement talent because his career extends so much further than that, to the point where he is actually still active now. He's not listed as retired. He only turns 60 next month. So he's still in the ring from time to time, probably not all that frequently. And at one time, Jugan was a major figure in Western Pennsylvania independent promotions under the name Lord Zoltan, which was actually done with face paint. He was wearing face paint back in the 70s when that was not all that common. And he, as a kid, this was rather interesting and kind of blew my mind. He loved wrestling as a kid, and he would sneak into the matches because it was during a time where kids were not allowed into wrestling. Imagine that. And he was the president of the Luis Martinez fan club. So this podcast has now had two separate, independent Luis Martinez references in one show. But when he became a wrestler, he worked for a lot of these so-called outlaw promotions, which I always find to be a really weird term. One of, you know, the outlaw promotions that's often cited is ICW, the Angelo Poffo promotion. It, basically, anybody who ran afoul of the cartel that was the National Wrestling Alliance. And I have no problem with that because the NWA as an entity, you know, a lot of people have fond memories and wish we could go back to those days, but it was not good for the wrestlers itself, and it was very anti-competitive, and I don't like that. I can't abide by that. So Jugan, actually, during his time, he worked in WWF as an enhancement guy, as I mentioned, but then he started refereeing matches for them in the Pittsburgh area and, you know, Western Pennsylvania. But, and people laugh when Gorilla Monsoon would say something like, you can't have a wrestler's license and a manager's license at the same time. It's like, oh, who cares? It's all, you know, it's wrestling here. Well, Jugan actually was prohibited from wrestling in Pennsylvania for a while because he had a referee's license as well, and they said you can't have a wrestler's license and a referee's license. And if that doesn't, you know, point directly to the heart of the absurdity of these state athletic commission regulations, I don't know what does. So yeah, as I said, he has not retired technically, and he would be one of the few quote-unquote active guys now who actually wrestled Andre the Giant. I mean, think about that. Andre, as of early next year, will have been dead for 25 years, hadn't wrestled regularly for even longer than that. There's probably other guys, you know, in Japan who maybe worked in those six-man tags. It's not coming to mind who those guys were, but certainly not a lot of guys left who are active wrestlers who wrestled against Andre the Giant. So yeah, Ken Jugan, a very interesting career that he carved for himself over the years. Sergeant Slaughter, of course, much more famous, and he is nearing the end of his heel run here. As I said, Wizard is still there, and they did not give him another manager during the brief period after his passing, which actually took place on October 12th. This match aired on the October 15th episode of All Star Wrestling. So it was a few days after the Wizard had passed away. So I don't know, I'll forgive them because it was only 3 days there. So this is the final shot of the Grand Wizard on television, and he salutes his charge, Sergeant Slaughter. And I'm rather taken by the Grand Wizard's outfit here, which is pretty outlandish, even for him. I talked more about him in episode 14, from the 1980 episode of Championship Wrestling from February 2nd, where he was with Ken Patera and got down on one knee to de-pants Kenny. And here, he's got a lot of, I don't know, military insignia, pieces of flair. I don't know. He's got a lot of stuff on his top there. So the Grand Wizard either looks like Sheriff David Clark of Milwaukee County or a waitress from Tchotchke's in the movie Office Space. I can't quite decide which one. The announcers I noticed during this time in late 83 and into early 84 would constantly stress the toughness of Sergeant Slaughter. And it seemed like that they had something in mind for him down the road, because they were a little bit more, they weren't as hard on Slaughter at this time, although the Gomer signs were out in full force here. And you'll see, if you look, go back on my Twitter about 5 days, I had a tweet that said that the originality was not exactly a strong suit of 83, 84 WWF crowds and the signs that they would make. Now, as they stress the toughness thing, Pat Patterson, kind of knowing and having the huge rivalry with Sergeant Slaughter in 1981, says, and I know, and he would know, because those matches were some fantastic stuff. Of course, that was a result of the Cobra Clutch challenge angle, where Patterson had pretty much broken the hold, but Slaughter let go and then attacked Patterson, kicking off that great feud. I actually have somewhere on my computer the episode. It's actually from Championship Wrestling, but I have an episode of All Star Wrestling which refers to that angle taking place. It shows the entire thing, and that's in my strategic reserve for right now. It's not on YouTube. It was on there ever so briefly, and then it got pulled. So that will be an episode down the line. Of course, I have to cover 1981. As I mentioned, I like to cover every year from 80 to 99 at some point. Interesting note about this match, there is a wet spot in the ring. Now get your mind out of the gutter, because that is actually from the famous Magnificent Morocco match where he ate a sandwich while disposing of Victor Mercado. So that had taken place earlier in the taping. Slaughter early on here is showing off his agility with a leapfrog and a drop toe hold, kind of showing off the fact that Slaughter is more than just a big guy who bumps around a lot and a big, you know, drill sergeant, all that jazz. That, oh yeah, he can wrestle too. And he puts on a bow and arrow. Kind of interesting to see that move from a guy that big. And you get kind of a miscommunication spot, but then I remembered, oh yeah, they probably slipped in the middle of the ring. It was going to be a corner-to-corner whip with a reversal, but things were so slick out there. So thanks a lot, Morocco, for basically creating an OSHA violation out there where people are going to slip and fall and you're going to have a workman's comp thing. Oh, wait, no, I'm sorry. They're not employees. They're independent contractors, right? So Jugan ends up hitting the buckles face first, and looked like he hit pretty hard. It was on a scale of 0 to 10 Bret Harts, I'd give it about 7.5 Bretts on that one. And the Cobra Clutch quickly finishes off Ken Jugan. And Slaughter, you know, the timing of his face turn couldn't have been much better. And I mentioned this in episode 2, because 1984 was kind of a year where America decided, you know what, we're going to stop feeling bad about ourselves. You know, say what you want about Reagan and all that, but that was kind of the feeling in the country between the Summer Olympics in 1984 and winning a lot of gold medals because communists were boycotting the Olympics. It seemed like a time the economy was picking up again. It seemed like a time that America was willing to at least feel good about itself again. And as I said, the economy was picking up. Of course, my theory on that is that the economy was lifted by record sales due to MTV, and that Michael Jackson's Thriller album single-handedly lifted the United States out of a recession. Just the sheer volume of sales of that album. But what the hell, I'm probably talking a bit of nonsense here. But we're not done with Sergeant Slaughter, because we got advertisement number two for Victory Magazine. And they are plugging the hell out of this for a magazine that wasn't even called Victory Magazine within a year of this. Like, you change to WWF Magazine. You have Sergeant Slaughter and what appears to be a picture of him on a TV in a living room. It's very, very, very old school looking television set. And it looks like one of those deals where Slaughter is on the TV and his lips are moving, but like the rest of his face is stationary. You might remember from the Conan O'Brien show years ago, they would do that where they would show somebody sitting there and then they would kind of have somebody else's lips superimposed on that. And personal story on that. In 1997, I did a cable access show called Friday Night Underground with my dear friend Bob Heck, who is available as the head of Bob Heck Entertainment for all your DJ needs in the greater Pittsfield, Mass. And Albany areas. So look him up, give him a call. So we hosted this show, and we actually did a bit where Bill Cosby, I'm doing the voice of Bill Cosby sitting on a couch there, and my lips are on, you know, Bill Cosby's mouth. We actually got some tips from a tech guy there. So we were making fun of Bill Cosby long before it was cool to make fun of Bill Cosby. So just a shout out for my 20-year-old cable access show, of which like two tapes still exist of that. So back to the living room here. Robert DeBoard, who is the publisher of Victory Magazine and the host of Victory Corner, which I also covered in episode 2, and how just weird and boring that guy is, he's on the sofa in a cardigan. Apparently he's doing some Mr. Rogers cosplay there. And he says that, "You're a Gomer," to Sergeant Slaughter on the TV, to which Slaughter gets mad, and then he emerges from the television set, like busts out of the TV, and comes over and slams DeBoard on the couch. So certainly an interesting spot there. And they say that Victory Magazine brings the action to you.
Wow. I guess Victory really does bring the action to you.
I'll give Vince credit for this. His in-house commercials that they were running at this time in 1983 were probably better than the in-ring product at the same time.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which of course includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the hard-traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes, and while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlacementNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlacementNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlacementNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The star of last week's show, Tony Garea's hair, accompanied by Tony Garea, here to take on Iron Mike Sharp in our next bout. And Iron Mike Sharp, of course, is known for being the loud guy who had OCD and the forearm thing, which was kind of his gimmick at this time as well, but in 1983 it was a little different for him. He was something of a pushed commodity. And his nickname, which was used by many other guys over the years, was Canada's Greatest Athlete, which that is some nerve considering that I think Wayne Gretzky was in the second year of his streak of 200-point seasons, which lasted at least through 1987. So for him to call himself that was quite a stretch. It was also done by Kaniski and others as well. But to kind of illustrate the kind of push he was getting, he had a match against Bob Backlund, main eventing at the Philadelphia Spectrum in April of 1983 for the world title. Think about Iron Mike Sharp wrestling for the world title. And in fact, he even got a shot at the Intercontinental title against the Magnificent Morocco in November of 83 at Madison Square Garden. Now, this was an unusual MSG show in that there was no TV for that. And Don Morocco was playing the babyface. So, kind of interesting there, Morocco going against type. But Sharp had a little bit of a push there. So, he's facing Tony Garea here. And they had something of a rivalry. They would face each other quite regularly. And 1983 was the year of the last Battle of Atlanta, the culmination of a feud between Tommy Rich and Buzz Sawyer in Georgia Championship Wrestling. Well, I'm here to say, screw those guys, because we got Tony Garea and Iron Mike Sharp putting on a series of their own. And this is match number 5 from 1983 between these two guys. July 4th, Wildwood, New Jersey. Tony Garea prevails via countout. I'm sure that was a barn burner. July 7th, Altoona, Pennsylvania. The two of them fought to a draw. 7-16, Philadelphia. Iron Mike Sharp wins by pinfall. So that's a big win in the larger arena. 7-30, Madison Square Garden. These two faced off to a draw. So this is the fifth match of what would ultimately be 6 matches in the year 1983. Score is now 1-1-2. This is not exactly the Marquis of Queensbury or Marquess of Queensbury that I went over a few episodes back between Ric Flair and Lord Steven Regal, but, you know, we got to take what we can get. Cage match records for these guys in 1983. Iron Mike Sharp had his last 500 year at 30 wins, 21 losses, 9 ties, and draws. I'm so used to calling it ties from looking at the NHL standings over the years. And Garea went 39-51-7. So he was under 500, and 82 was the last year that he had more wins than losses. Of course, cage match can often be incomplete, but just think of it as a solid sampling of what their overall record would have been in the end. Kind of an analysis of this match is this gets underway, Pat Patterson says, "I can't pick a winner here." And that's kind of a bad omen from one of the bookers. So you can kind of see what's coming. They already got two draws under their belt earlier this year. Gurria has a advantage early, and they do a crisscross spot, which is forever amusing to me because, you know, it just evokes Hogan and Warrior doing the crisscross spot at the 90 Royal Rumble and at WrestleMania 6. And you know what? That Halloween Havoc 98 match really, really sucked. But it's because I don't think they did a crisscross spot during it. That was their good luck charm. They needed to do a crisscross spot. We got Dick Worley is our referee here, and I am not a fan of his, and I've said this before, because his counts are so unbelievably inconsistent. Like, often on the very, very fast side. If anything, I would rather it be a slightly slower than normal count than one that is noticeably fast. And finally, after all these weeks of saying the line in my gorilla voice, I finally get to hear it from Gino Monsoon himself.
This is the main event in any arena anywhere in the country, Pat.
I am picturing the Wrestling Observer for some reason right now. And Dave Meltzer is reporting on the WWF running a show in Los Angeles. Let's say the Olympic Auditorium, because I know they ran that venue in 1984. And their main event, let's assume, is Tony Gurria versus Iron Mike Sharp. Meltzer's copy would probably read something like, WWF drew 438 paid to the Olympic Auditorium for a main event of Tony Gurria versus Iron Mike Sharp. They went to a 30-minute draw in 1829. I think it would probably go something like that. I don't mean to crap on these guys or anything, but it's just how when Gorilla says that, he never says it for a legitimate main event. And that is what makes it funny. So you got a long-ass side headlock sequence by Iron Mike Sharp here. And he keeps doing the thing where he's grabbing the hair of Gurria to gain leverage. To be honest, though, can you really help but grab that mane of hair that, as I said, a head of hair that 19-year-olds would covet? And there's not a lot of moves in this match. And yeah, I ripped Gurria as kind of a singles worker because he lacks any sort of dynamic offense at all. He's like something out of the 70s at this point. Now, granted, we're only a couple of years removed from that, but this is a guy who, in my time traveling thing, where if I took Tony Gurria from 1983 and tried to pluck him into 1995, he would be more out of place than Brendan Fraser in that movie Encino Man. And boy, I never thought I would make a reference to that one. It's just really an arm drag wrist lock, which is Gurria's move, versus side headlock and forearm smash, which are Sharp's moves. Anyway, they try to wake me up by talking about baseball in a very oblique sort of way, talking about Dick Worley's job as an official, incorrectly saying that he's a good official. They say, oh, well, sometimes you see an umpire call it a strike and everybody there thinks it's a ball. Well, just wait for Pitch FX to come across 30 years from now, Pat, and it's going to be even more controversy, and people are going to be calling for robot umpires for whatever reason. Finally, about 7 minutes into this match, Gorilla suggests that maybe Gurria should go to work on the right arm instead of the left arm, because if he's really injured and has that brace on there for a reason, that would be a weak point. But Gurria continues working the left arm, and this is just not very good. And thankfully, 10-minute time limit, it's mercifully cut short at about 8.5 to 9 minutes. The finish isn't even like one that you usually see in a time limit draw on TV, where you get a near pin by the babyface on the heel, allowing everybody to stay face. No, we get a slam and a missed elbow, and then just the bell rings. So, what a finish designed there. This was not anything that aired on Championship Wrestling or on All-Star. This was taped in Allentown for the purposes of airing it on All-American at some point. And I don't even know why they bothered. Except for the after the match, Sharp goes out and grabs one of those, what I like to call the Bruno chair. It's the style of wood chair that Bruno got beamed with by Zbyszko in 1980. But Gorilla somehow grabs it from him, and he gets control of it. And he kind of swings it, but doesn't get anything. And I don't know. I'd say the best part of this match is, well, when it ended, and when Joe McHugh, just the way that Joe McHugh announced the time limit draw was pretty fantastic.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, this bout went to the full, fast and furious 10-minute time limit. The referee declares the bout a draw.
Well, I admire Joe McHugh's dedication to putting that match over a little extra in some way. That was certainly more Tokyo Drift than Too Fast, Too Furious. And now for another bizarre segment. This one, the workout with Bob Backlund, still the World Wrestling Federation champion, and the rehabbing Eddie Gilbert. And this is not for pills or drugs. This is for his neck injury, which was mainly sustained, as I had mentioned, he had the wreck after a TV taping in May. But they also did an angle in September that aired on Championship Wrestling, and then later on All-American Wrestling in October, where he lost to the Masked Superstar, who was very new, and they were building up, and he did a stretcher job after taking a couple of corkscrew neck breakers from Bill Eadie, of course, is the Masked Superstar. So they're building up Eddie Gilbert for this comeback here, and they do it in a very kind of annoying and also somewhat disturbing way with Backlund. And we all kind of know, if you know anything about the right before Hulk Hogan came in the end of 1983, early 1984, that Bob Backlund was very annoying in 1983, to the point where he was like the original Bonnie Donna. It's easy for me to say. He was like Rip the Bonnie Donna or Flip the Bonnie Donna. Think of whatever rhyme you might want. He was doing the Harvard step test for an entire episode until he got punked by Sergeant Slaughter. That was back in, I believe it was May, and was doing all sorts of exercise things the various weeks on television. He even changed his look at a certain point and started wearing a singlet, which looked kind of hokey compared with the other guys in the promotion. And Backlund actually covered this in his book for his 1983, and he knew that things weren't going to go quite so well. Let me just read a few excerpts from what he said in his book, Backlund, From All-American Boy to Professional Wrestling's World Champion, which came out in 2015, and is a very good read, and I'm trying to get through a series on my blog, section309.com, where I do highlights of it. I'm only through four or five parts, and I'm only up to probably about 1980 or so, so it's kind of a slow slog there. The middle of 1983 was a time of transition in the office, and it definitely showed in some of the bookings around the territory. And yeah, as I said, Vince didn't fully take over until the middle of the year, so they're kind of in a holding pattern until then. And for the last 6 months of 1983, Vince is kind of waiting at that time to make his move. That's not an excerpt. I try to do a different voice when I read an excerpt, but it can be a little difficult here. Back to Backlund here. I faced a strange array of challengers to the title in the summer of 1983, from the expected matches against Morocco, Ivan Koloff, and Sergeant Slaughter in the larger arenas, to other, less plausible matches against AFA, Mr. Fuji, and Iron Mike Sharp in some of the smaller towns. Well, you know, he did face Sharp in Philadelphia, as I mentioned earlier. Superstar defeated Gilbert easily after punishing him with not one but two swinging neckbreakers in the ring, then threw him out of the ring and delivered the neckbreaker to the still recovering Gilbert out on the arena's concrete floor. Of course, that's what led to this little segment here. It was around this time that I decided to cut my hair short and to go back to wearing a singlet. No one told me to do it. I chose to do that myself. So now we know who to blame for the change in Bob Backlund for 1983 with his hair, and the entire presentation, even his muscle mass, had gone down noticeably. And I had always heard, oh, the fans turned on Bob Backlund. And I kind of, even though I've grown to appreciate Bob Backlund and didn't really, you know, like him all that much, say, 20 years ago when I looked back at the pre-Hulkamania days, it was because I wasn't able to actually see his matches in 1980 with Ken Patera, his matches with Sergeant Slaughter. So I wasn't able to fully develop any sort of appreciation for him. But I never understood at the same time the whole the fans turned on him in 1983. I thought, well, that's just Meltzer talk and whoever saying, oh, well, they were booing Backlund, because of course Meltzer always had it in for Backlund at that time, even up through his 90s run, I believe. So I'm listening to a recent Exile on Bad Street on the history of WWF in the Boston Garden, where John McAdam was on with Chris Zellner, and he was talking about Backlund's title defenses in 1983, and he was saying that the crowd really did turn on Bob Backlund. Of course, Backlund was never the most popular figure in Boston, because Boston was always a Bruno town during that time, and in fact, earlier in the 80s, Bruno was being put in main events when they could get him until he retired in 81 in place of Backlund, because he was much more of a draw. So the fans were actually starting to get tired of it, and this is extremely rare. This is not like the fans chanting stuff at Roman Reigns or John Cena. In 1983, it was a different kind of wrestling fan there. You cheered the babyfaces and you booed the heels. And that's how it was. There was really no sort of crossover there. And Backlund, his time had just really run up at this point. And it's not like he was an old man or anything. He's only like 34, 35 years old. So he's in his mid-30s. He has a lot of good years left. But in wrestling, as we've learned, and it's particularly instructive to look at the career of The Undertaker, you have to evolve at some point over time. You cannot kind of keep the same thing. Sometimes you evolve and you put on a singlet and you get a crew cut, and that doesn't work. But it really wasn't much of an evolution from what Backlund was with that all-American boy thing. Things were starting to change a bit from the more technical wrestlers of the 1970s who were babyfaces. Think of Jack Briscoe, for example, and into the more kick-ass babyfaces, i.e. Hulk Hogan. So this segment here is a, they're in kind of a dark dungeony room with a wrestling mat there, and the audio is quite disturbing here, and I'll get to that in a moment. And Bob is helping Eddie Gilbert with his neck strengthening exercises, kind of doing like these flips where he's standing on his head and going one way and the other. And then they bust out a wheel later where he pushes it back and forth. It's kind of really hard to explain these. I'm not exactly a gym rat, so I don't know the terms for these things. And you should definitely watch this segment if you watch anything from this show, because it's, okay, Backlund easily does all these exercises because, of course, he's not hurt. He's, you know, still in pretty good shape and all that. And Eddie Gilbert is struggling to get through all of it. And Bob is just shouting slogans at him the entire time to motivate him. And as I said, the audio of this is just really, really weird.
Okay. Can we do a high push over here? Up. Down. Up. Down. Up. Down, up, down, up, down, up, down.
Oh, come on. Come on. Get
do it. Come on. Come on. Keep your head up there.
Squeal.
All right, Bob didn't turn it into a scene from Deliverance there. I made that last part up. But yes, very disturbing. It's kind of like the way that they would make the Stu Hart dungeon sound, that Stu was stretching guys down there. Of course, this is just normal exercise. And Bob, just being the late 1983 Bob that he was, says to Eddie at one point, "You can do this when I'm not around," referring to the wheel exercise. "I know you're disciplined." Well, you know, Eddie Gilbert sometimes would be a little bit flaky and show a lack of discipline at times, which may or may not have harmed his career later in the 1980s. So, yeah, just kind of a bizarre interlude and a bit of a small window into the oddness of what Bob Backlund's title reign became in late 1983. Get a little promo for the USA Network presentation of the Wrestling from Madison Square Garden, which is actually that October 17th, 1983 card, the one that Mick Foley hitchhiked to, Tommy Dreamer, Bubba Ray Dudley, all those guys were at that show for the classic Morocco snooker cage match, which only lasted 6:46. In my memory, that match was, you know, a 15-minute thing, but no, very, very short, but certainly not the shortest match on that night, as the final match was Andre the Giant over Afa the Samoan in 1:07 with a boot and a sit-down splash. So, true classic to close out that card at Madison Square Garden. And we have our final bout, which is Hulk Hogan versus Adrian Adonis, before those guys had come back for their main runs. Now, I got to play the Vince audio here of him introducing this match, because it, one thing he says is just amazing.
"You, ladies and gentlemen, to the American Wrestling Association, and frequent two of the outstanding wrestlers to ever step foot into the squared circles of the AWA, in reference to Adrian Adonis. Mr. Adonis has no doubt made a tremendous reputation for himself, and so has his opponent at near 300 pounds, the incredible Hulk Hogan. We now take you to the match, the highlights of the matchup, Adonis against Hulk Hogan."
Talked earlier about Adrian Adonis's time in Southwest shortly before this. But of course, he was a great tag worker with Murdoch, and he was a part of the Real World Tag League in Japan in both 82 and 83. In 82, his partner was Dino Bravo. So he probably took around, even though Dino Bravo was far less sucky in 1982 than he would be at the end of the 1980s, he said, how am I going to upgrade here? So he called in Captain Redneck, Dick Murdoch, and in 1983, they actually made it to the finals of the Real World Tag League, losing to Hulk Hogan's team, which I'll get into in a second. Hulk Hogan, in late 83, yes, it's thought of, he was in the AWA, and then he jumped from the AWA directly to the WWF. And that is true, but, well, Hogan was kind of a man about town for much of the second half of 1983. That Super Sunday business in April of that year kind of left a sour taste in everybody's mouth. Hogan probably expected to at least get a run with the belt for a while. Gagne probably expected Hogan to take the belt in exchange for earnings in Japan, because Vern Gagne was an extremely delusional man. So he leaves the AWA at least for a little while and starts doing other things. My first question when kind of exploring the Hulk Hogan of this time period is, was he signed to a WWF contract when this episode aired? And the answer is probably no. Although one of the more interesting things about the contract with Hulk Hogan and the WWF is apparently the Madison Square Garden Company may or may not have provided some help some financial assistance to Vince in terms of inking Hogan to what undoubtedly was a huge contract. So no, I don't believe he was signed, sealed, delivered at this point, because he's still wrestling. He still has dates in the AWA where he actually showed up. November 14th in Phoenix is actually his last date, where he beat Jerry Blackwell in a match and also won a battle royal, which seems like a hell of a way for a guy to go out of a promotion. So, but that's his last recorded AWA stuff. He was also listed on an early Starrcade 83 card, which of course did not come to fruition at all, where he was to team with Wahoo McDaniel against Dick Slater and Bob Orton, the two guys who were going for the bounty to put Ric Flair out. And the idea was that Wahoo and Hogan were there to avenge Ric Flair in some way. Of course, that never happened, and Hogan was actually over in Japan in the Real World Tag League, emerging victorious in his team with Antonio Inoki. So you've heard of the Mega Powers, you've heard of the Mega Maniacs. This team, I'm going to informally call the Ego Maniacs. Can you imagine that team of Inoki and Hogan? Just the level of ego. Now, granted, I've always said that Hogan's ego didn't spiral out of control until after March 29th, 1987, WrestleMania 3. At that point, after that point, he's a completely different guy. But Inoki had enough of an ego just by himself to raise it to stratospheric heights. Those two guys teaming up, and of course, they win the 1983 Real World Tag League. Hogan would also pop into St. Louis from time to time, working NWA cards there. In October, he actually beat Harley Race, the champion, by disqualification in one match. So I thought that was a rather interesting result. And of course, Hogan made his WWF debut on December 27th, 1983, at the Wrestling at the Chase tapings in St. Louis. So that is a city that knew him very well when the WWF brought him in there. And Hogan even popped into Montreal for a shot, teaming with Dino Bravo, the local hero. So that's two Dino Bravo references here today, and that's two Luis Martinez references. So I never know exactly where this show is going to take me when I start my research and all that kind of business. Now, the highlights of the match, it's very dark in the arena, and it's impossible, actually, to determine when this was. But based on results that I found from the AWA, this is probably from the fall of 1982, I'd say October time frame. And Hogan, you know, my fascination with the Hulk Hogan alternate uniform system, he is in the white trunks with the red knee pads. So be sure to mark that down on your score pad. We only get 4 or 5 minutes of this match. As Vince did point out, we were only getting highlights. And it starts with Hogan working a side headlock on the mat. And seems like I've seen a lot of side headlocks on this show today. It was 83, the year of the side headlock. And he gets thrown off and we get a clothesline by Adonis. So Hogan is down and he actually ends up outside the ring. And Adonis, you can't really see this because the AWA in their great production of the time period only has one camera. This might have been just a recorded house show, so I might be unfair here. Adonis hits him with a chair, and there's no DQ here. The referee is looking right at it. So this is the AWA, but it's looking like ECW for whatever reason, although maybe it could be a no disqualification match. None of this is spelled out at all. We get a big kick out by Hogan back in the ring at two, but no Hulk up yet. And then an inverted atomic drop by Adonis, which also gets two. But then you get some left hands by Adonis, and you get I have to admit, this was kind of refreshing. A very subtle Hulk up by Hogan. And they end up outside again during the Hulk up. And then it just kind of cuts back to Vince there. But I want to call special attention. I believe it's Rod Trongard on the call here for the AWA. It's kind of hard to figure out the voice there. And they did not identify who it was. As Hogan is hulking up, Trongard uses the phrase, "Katie, bar the door." And I kind of thought to myself, what is Katie bar the door? I've heard that phrase so many times, and what is its origins? It's certainly not a wrestling thing. It kind of has apparently a reference to Catherine Douglas, who tried to prevent the assassination of King James I of Scotland in 1437. And this is referenced apparently in a poem in 1881 by Dante Gabriel Rossetti, no relation to the Rossetti sisters of the Bobby Heenan show fame, who recounted the story in The King's Tragedy. The poem contains the line, "Catherine, keep the door." And that got changed at some point to "Katie, bar the door," which is a warning of an approach of trouble. So yes, that's one thing. On a 1983 WWF show, you have to insert some sort of poetry and literature at some point and class this thing up here. And speaking of classing this thing up, they're not done, because we got the third Victory magazine ad. And right now we have a similar deal where it's in the living room and it's Jimmy Snuka on the TV set. And they ask a question to which I have an immediate retort.
Who wouldn't like to have one of the only Superfly Snuka right in your very own living room?
Well, Nancy Argentino, for one, if I was a recovering addict, I probably wouldn't want Snuka around me then. If I was trying to read Victory magazine, or really any sort of publication, 19th century poetry or whatever, I probably wouldn't want Jimmy Snuka hanging around me. You know, just saying, that's all. So they go to the Iron Sheik now, who is hanging around New York City, and they're talking about some expensive purchases that the Iron Sheik and Ayatollah Fred Blassie are looking to make. And Iron Sheik had just come back in, so he was not there that long before the title passed through his hands and into Hulk Hogan. And to me, he's the perfect opponent to pass the title through. Had they done it through the Masked Superstar or through Bob Orton or any other guy you name, you don't get the same effect, because you're trying to create Hulk Hogan as the all-American hero. And it doesn't work quite as well if he's beating the Masked Superstar. It just doesn't have that same effect. And yes, the United States still had an extremely tense relationship with Iran, and which really, quite frankly, continues to this day. But you say, okay, the hostage thing took place in 1979. What was going on in 1983, 84? There wasn't anything truly direct with the United States and Iran. A lot of it was done through Iran's proxy in Lebanon at that point. And if you want to learn more about Lebanon and that whole horrific situation that started in the mid-70s and really continued for years and years and years, I recommend the book From Beirut to Jerusalem by the New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman, which I can assure you he wrote that before he went crazy and just kind of went off the deep end in the last decade or so, where he became convinced that his shit does not stink. But I actually met Tom Friedman at a book signing. He was at my Barnes & Noble in Bethesda, Maryland back in 2002. So I have a chance to talk to him. You know, I'm a student of international relations. I can ask him about anything. So what do I do when I go up to him? I ask him, who does he think is going to win the 2002 Major League Baseball playoffs and win the World Series? Which was stupid, because he's originally from Minnesota. So he's a Minnesota Twins fan. So he was pro Twins. And they actually did make it to the ALCS that year, before falling to the Anaheim Angels, the eventual World Series champions. Back to Lebanon here and Iran. So Iran was kind of exerting a lot of control over Lebanon at that time through their proxy, Hezbollah, which of course is a familiar name to anybody who's familiar with international terrorism over the last half century. And of course, it was in 1983, the bombing of the American embassy in Beirut, and also the bombing of a Marines barracks, which killed 241 U.S. Marines who were there as peacekeepers in Lebanon. The group Islamic Jihad took responsibility for that attack, and they are also closely linked with the Khomeini Iranian government of the time period. So the tensions were very high at that point, between the United States and Iran, it just wasn't as obvious as they've taken American hostages in the embassy the way it was in 1979. So yes, they're it's complicated, but they are still the enemy. And they're the enemy to the point where the United States is arming Saddam Hussein in Iraq in an effort to either keep that war going or to put down Iran. Of course, that might be a reason why the Iraq war was a mistake, because weakening and creating a failed state in Iraq only emboldened Iran. But thankfully, nothing horrific has happened quite yet. But boy, that's some heavy stuff here. I did not expect to go to these places for WWF 1983. Again, it's amazing this ride that I go on each week with all this. So why don't we lighten the mood a bit here at the end of the show for another solid edition of YouTube Comment Theater. Now, this video is on one of the more popular channels for any wrestling fan like me to watch old stuff. Again, I don't name names anymore ever since The Purge, and before that happened, there were more videos of All American Wrestling during this time period where they were showing guys from other promotions with the idea of introducing them to the audience. So more than a few people weigh in on this. This has 6,200 views on YouTube, although I think 150 of them have been me in trying to get through the show. I've kind of watched this show in about 10 different choppy parts. This has been one of my stranger research weeks. And also, this is probably one of the stranger shows that I've done, particularly with the last 10 minutes there. Jay Wilson says, "Wow, that is hysterical. Vince had by this point made arrangements with Hogan to come into the WWF unbeknownst to the AWA. Here they're using the old arrangements with other territories to use AWA footage of Hogan to get WWF fans familiar with him prior to his return. Vince was going for the jugular." And yeah, you know, some of them did not realize what exactly Vince was doing here. They thought he was doing this out of the goodness of his heart. Of course, there were a few people that knew. Terry Funk went over that in his book. Of course, familiarizing Hulk Hogan with the WWF audience, as I explained in episode 2, they actually had to make an effort to portray Hogan as a babyface by putting him, oddly enough, next to Bob Backlund, who I had said was getting boos and all that. But the idea was to remind the fans that Hulk Hogan, who's back, is not the evil guy that he was before. He's changed his ways, as Bob Backlund once said. Scott Smart says, "Wow, guess this is before Vince's expansion, since that's a CWF match between Wyndham and a jobber called by Soli and Eddie Graham. And the Hogan match is from the AWA? Tune in to WWF Wrestling to watch almost no WWF wrestling." And yeah, that's what's entirely bizarre about this, is that half the matches are WWF matches and half are from other territories, and then you have the Moolah match in there, which is some sort of hybrid, although she was really part of the promotion. Kane Robot says, "Don't worry, Joe McHugh, I also would have said Penny Marshall. You have no idea, when I was going through that match, how many times I thought I was going to say Penny Marshall for Penny Mitchell instead, and I had to stop myself because I'm making fun of Gorilla and Joe McHugh for that. And if I say it myself, well, that would have really made me look bad. Clearly, I can edit it, but I did manage to get through without having to edit it out." By the way, Gorilla, at the end of the match, did call her Penny Marshall for a second time. So it's, I only played it up once, but I didn't want to beat it too much into the ground. Mr. Perksy says, "Vince's sports coat looks like the suits The Rock wears in the show Ballers." I don't have enough of a familiarity with the show Ballers on HBO. When it comes to Sunday night HBO, my thing is Veep for the time that that's around in the spring, and Last Week Tonight, hosted by John Oliver, who I believe just signed a contract extension through 2020 or 2021, something like that. Gotta sneak this in. My favorite episode of Veep of all time, surprise, surprise, is Season 1, Episode 6, where they go to Camden Yards for the Healthy Eating Initiative, which features some of my favorite lines in the show's history. Benjamin Kellogg says, "Kind of disappointed we didn't get that Hogan match in its entirety here. Anyone have an idea as to why not? I guess either Hogan lost clean or Adonis caused a DQ. You'd think Vince would want to show Hogan in a more dominant light for the eventual title switch. Maybe there just wasn't as much of that kind of footage in the batch of AWA tapes that Vince must have had lying around the office. I can just imagine him clutching some random AWA Hogan tape and softly whispering Precious, Gollum style. Well, Hogan did beat Adonis clean in all the results that I saw from late 1982, so that was not an issue. So the idea of Hogan jobbing cleanly, he wasn't doing many jobs in the AWA, if at all. In fact, I don't know if he lost any singles matches after his babyface turn, at least cleanly. There's nothing that I can recall off the top of my head. And finally, Chuck Gonk says, Penny Marshall? And Styles Bitchley replies, yeah, you know, Gary's sister? To which Dan Livney replies, yes, she was on Laverne and Shirley and then went on to wrestle in the WWF. So, yeah, the show's canceled, so might as well catch on working for Moolah for virtually no money and horrific conditions and all that. So that'll do it for YouTube Comment Theater. Now, in my zeal to cover all years, you know, my 1980 to 1999 thing that I've mentioned earlier, I've left kind of a few holes in wrestling history for that time period. Like, for example, I haven't covered a WCW show from 1992, renowned as one of the best years in WCW history, at least early on before Bill Watts kind of squashed everything with his total weirdness. Well, I'm going to take a look at a WCW 92 show for next week, and actually it'll be the first trip to Center Stage Theater, as it is a episode of WCW Saturday Night that is a one-hour edition, so it meets my personal criteria so that I don't go crazy. It was taped June 1st, 1992, and aired on June 20th as a sort of pregame show to the Beach Blast 92 pay-per-view. And there's a lot going on. You had Bill Watts just taking over about 4 to 6 weeks before this time frame. Steve Austin capturing a title. And this is what I'm most excited about, is I'm going to be able to talk about some people that I haven't talked about in 31 episodes. I don't think there's been a Steve Austin match in any of my shows thus far, unless I'm completely blanking on one. There's also Johnny B. Badd and how he became my patron saint when I was writing reviews on a message board a few years ago. The Steiner brothers are in action, although I have seen Rick Steiner in the UWF. I have not seen the brother tag team in WCW. And I don't know if this is the feature bout or whatever, but we have a Greg Valentine versus Tom Zenk match that was really, really satisfying for a lot of different reasons. And it's got nothing to do with Tom Zenk being a bit of a hunk or whatever. And we got Dusty Rhodes on the commentary there with Jim Ross, at least for most of the card. So a lot of fun with the American Dream, as I said, on the mothership. All right, that was a pretty bad Dusty Rhodes, so I'll work on it before next week. So do tune in then for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.